industrial accidents,
ancient
solving
poisoners,
crime,
poison
chemical
prevention.
Spills. This is Toxic History.
I want to introduce Professor Rachel Gorodetsky. She is now an associate professor at the Yeovil School of Pharmacy in Buffalo with affiliations at the University of Rochester Medical Center and the Upstate New York Poison Center. With that, I'm going to give you the mic. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. This presentation was real pleasure to put together. I went with Laboratory X, Russia's Poison Laboratory, and the Art of Assassination. I do have some objectives, which I certainly intend to achieve, but I'd rather spend my time on the main event. So we are going to dive straight into historical context. So this is Karl Marx. You probably have heard of him. He is known for having written a couple of small publications opining his thoughts on capitalism, which were not super positive. And at some point, those writings were picked up by this gentleman, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, who found them extremely inspirational. And Lenin started pitching the communist philosophy to his people, and he gained quite a lot of support to the point that in October of 1917, his revolutionaries of his Bolshevik party executed the coup d'etat, which was later called the October Revolution or Red October, and ushered in the world's first communist state. Now, within a year of Lenin assuming power, there was a nearly successful assassination attempt on him where he was shot twice. And there's a version of this story that said the bullets that he was shot with were poisoned with curare. There's no actual evidence that was the case, and it was really considered debunked. Nevertheless, Lenin was told all about this and briefed on curare as a poison, and supposedly that sparked a real fascination with poisons in Lenin to the point that in 1921, he established this poison laboratory within his own governmental buildings in Lubyanka Square in Moscow. The laboratory changed names and locations and leadership over time, but it always had the same prime directive to develop poisons for use by the state in instances of assassinations or individual terror. It was originally headed by a couple of guys named Kazakov and Yagoda. They were both executed in 1938 in the third Moscow show trial, which was a series of trials that were orchestrated by Stalin to get rid of political opponents. But that was okay because the lab really came into its own under its new head, Dr. Grigory Myronovsky, who earned the moniker Dr. Death, and his friend Vasily Blokhin, who was in charge of the nearby Lubyanka prison and ensured the constant availability of prisoners for experimentation with these poisons. Myronovsky had a personal mission that was also his directorate, which was to develop a poison that would be devoid of taste or smell that could not be detected after death. And initially, he was very interested in the nitrogen mustards and mustard gas derivatives, but he was disappointed with those because they were too easy to detect after they had been used. And so he went on to look into several other poisons, including things like ricin and digitoxin and curare. And supposedly, he became very enamored with and really impressed with the properties of a chemical that he called K2, carbamylamine choline chloride, which, when tested on prisoners, would result in death within 15 minutes. Under the new KGB director, or the NKVD, technically, director, which was the predecessor of the KGB, the lab really was given virtually free rein to develop and test and create delivery devices for poisons for the purpose of individual terror. Now, the lab was developing not only poisons that were designed to kill, but also so-called soft chemicals, which were designed to not kill, but to threaten, punish, or incapacitate the victim, or to be used for interrogation. So this would include things like the truth serums that they had been working on. So notable cases of soft chemicals being used include these three listed here. There was Horst Schwenkman, who was a German gentleman who had the job of debugging German political buildings or, you know, official buildings from KGB planted listening devices, which Moscow obviously found very annoying. And so in 1964, on a trip to Moscow, where he was debugging the German embassy there, he was attacked and shot in the buttock with a preparation of mustard gas, which caused excruciating pain and dermal injury, but did not kill him because, of course, it wasn't intended to kill. The case of Viktor Yushchenko is pretty well known. He was the Ukrainian presidential candidate who was poisoned with dioxin and very physically disfigured from the chloracne that resulted. But then in the picture is Anna Politkovskaya, who was a journalist and political activist who was poisoned while on a plane where she was headed to report on a hostage crisis. This was another Chechen hostage crisis, similar to the Moscow theater incident. But while in flight, she drank some tea, after which she lost consciousness. And she woke up in a hospital where the nurse told her she had been poisoned. And that poisoning was presumably also not intended to kill, but simply to stop her from reporting on this incident, which did not cast the Russians in a very good light. Now we're going to move into some of the bigger stories of people who were poisoned and the people who poisoned them. And hopefully these are stories that you haven't already heard. I chose them mostly because they were new to me when I started researching this. So we're going to start with this gentleman, Nikolai Hohlov. He was born in 1922, and before starting his espionage activities, he was actually a professional variety performer who was known especially for being half of a duet whistling act. And so as a fun fact, he was an informer on the Moscow intelligentsia, and when he gave his reports to the NKVD, he would sign them with the pseudonym Whistler. But it was in 1954 that he was tasked with the assassination of a guy named Georgi Akolovich, who was the leader of the NTS, which was just an anti-Soviet organization in Frankfurt. And this is a picture of Akolovich with Hohlov, who actually did become friends, as we'll find out. Hohlov wasn't actually intended to be the assassin in this case. He was just in charge of the assassination plan. And he was supposed to organize the two actual killers and make sure that the plan was carried off appropriately. But instead, he didn't want to go through with the murder. And so he walked up to Akolovich's front door, knocked on it, and declared himself and said, "There's an assassination plot against you, which I am charged with carrying out, but I don't want to do it." And he put himself at the mercy of his would-be victim. And as a result, he was invited in for a cup of tea. Akolovich suggested that they go to the Western authorities to ask for help, which they did. And so working with the American Secret Service, Hohlov arranged for the capture of his two accomplices, who he convinced to defect with him, and turned over to the Americans the weapons that they were intending to use in their assassination, which included, in this picture, a miniature gun that was disguised as a cigarette case, along with another miniature handgun and a silencer with supposedly poisoned lead bullets that were poisoned with cyanide. But that isn't even the most exciting part of this story, because of course that assassination wasn't even carried out. But after he defected, Hohlov was ultimately granted asylum and settled in the United States. But both immediately after the defection and later on in the US, he was very strongly and publicly critical of the Soviet regime. And it was a few years later that he probably unwisely decided to return to Europe for a conference of anti-communist activists in Frankfurt. And according to him, the story goes that on the final day of the conference, he walked out onto the terrace during a break and ordered a cup of coffee, which seemed to take an unusually long time to arrive. And because of that, he ended up being in a hurry, and he says he only drank a very small amount before he left it and went back in to attend more of the conference. But shortly thereafter, he became acutely ill with nausea, fatigue, and abdominal pain. He went to the hospital, was diagnosed with acute gastritis, but his symptoms continued to escalate over many days. He developed so-called lines on his fingernails, pain in his hands and feet, a hemorrhagic skin eruption, mucositis, hair loss, and bone marrow suppression. He was ultimately diagnosed with poisoning by radioactive thallium, although unfortunately no testing of his skin, hair, or urine was able to confirm that diagnosis. It is pointed out in the records that all of this testing was done on samples taken much later in his clinical course, and that there are no samples from early on to conduct testing on. It's worth mentioning that although most sources do state unequivocally that he was poisoned with radioactive thallium, he survived, by the way. It has been suggested by at least one ex-KGB agent that he was in fact poisoned with polonium-210, exactly as Litvinenko would be 50 years later. And it points out that Litvinenko's illness was initially misdiagnosed as thallium poisoning as well. But we followed that with the story of the case of Bogdan Stashinsky. This was a young man from a modest peasant family that lived outside Lviv in western Ukraine. And his family were strong Ukrainian patriots and supporters of this Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, which was an organization that opposed the Soviet state in western Ukraine, which had recently been annexed. So his home was a known safe house for members of the OUN and the insurgent army in the nearby region. He had two sisters who were active in the organization. But in the summer of 1950, while he was on a visit home from where he attended college in Lviv, he was brought in for questioning by an NKVD officer, wherein it was made plain that they knew all about his family's involvement with the OUN, and that he could either become an informer for them, or he and his family would all be arrested and either imprisoned or sent to Siberia. So not really given much of a choice, he did agree. So after training for a few years in espionage, he began his activities related to this gentleman, Lev Rybet. Rybet was a political activist, member of the OUN, and a newspaper editor who was living in Munich with his family. And it was in the spring of 1957 that Stashinsky was given his first task, which was simply finding where Rybet lived in Munich, which when he completed that in the summer, he gave his report and he didn't hear anything about it for a while. And he thought actually that his involvement with this particular case must be done. But that abruptly changed. In September of 1957, Stashinsky was invited to a meeting where he was briefed on this new weapon. It was, as he describes, a metal cylinder, single barrel, about 8 inches long and less than an inch in diameter, which was equipped with a trigger and also a safety catch. There were small glass ampules of poison, which would be placed into the cylinder and would spray their contents out when hit by a gunpowder discharge upon pressing the trigger. He said he was told that if this was aimed at the chest or face of a victim, the poison would be inhaled and it would lead to death within minutes, and then the poison would evaporate, leaving no trace behind. And so it was at this point that Stashinsky realized that he was intended to become an assassin. So in October, just a month later, October 1957, Stashinsky traveled to Munich with, among certainly other ordinary items, two cans of Frankfurt sausages. The poison weapon was concealed within one of the cans. And after 3 days of surveillance, he finally spots Rybet, who is heading towards his office in downtown Munich. Upon seeing him, he enters the office building ahead of him and heads up to the second floor landing. When he hears Rybet coming up the stairs, Stashinsky starts going down, and as they pass each other, he discharges the weapon from inside a rolled-up newspaper directly into Rybet's face. He didn't stay around to see what happened, but went directly to a park where there was a bridge over a canal, and he dumped his weapon there. Rybet was found about 20 minutes later deceased, and his cause of death was ruled natural and cardiac in nature. He was actually never thought to be poisoned or anything of the sort until much later. So after that initial success, enter the case of Stepan Bandera. He was the leader of the OUN. He was living in Munich under an assumed name. And this was a guy with a very long history of anti-Soviet activity, worked his way up in the ranks of the OUN, spent many years in prison before ultimately he was free and he settled in West Germany, essentially living in exile and still acting as leader of the OUN. Definitely somebody that the KGB was interested in getting rid of. It was in 1959 that Stashinsky received a new and improved double-barreled version of the poison gun and a new assignment to hunt down and kill Bandera. In October 1959, he, again, after a few days of watching, he sees Bandera arrive at his residence in a car, goes into the building ahead of him and up to the second floor landing as he had before with Ribiette. In a slight turn of events that wasn't quite as planned, Bandera didn't come up the stairs, but instead started struggling to open the door because he had a handful of groceries in one arm and he was like struggling with the key with the other hand. And at that point, Stashinsky simply walked up to him and discharged both barrels of the weapon, again wrapped in newspaper, into Bandera's face. Again, he didn't stick around to see what happened. He went immediately to the park where he threw the weapon in the same canal as he had disposed of the first one. Unlike Ribiette, although Bandera's death was initially ruled an accident, it had looked like he had fallen down the stairs and that was his cause of death. Suspicions did quickly arise just because of the strange nature of his death and who he was. And an autopsy that was performed in the following days detected traces of potassium cyanide in Bandera's stomach. And so his death was quickly ruled an assassination by poisoning. And in the picture, you can see a dispatch that was sent from the American consulate to Washington that describes the case of his assassination by poisoning. The reason that we know how these assassinations were carried out in such detail is that Stashinsky, like Ribiette, defected shortly thereafter. And the story of his defection is really a harrowing tale that I wanted to be able to tell you, but sadly, there is no time. So perhaps another time we can tell that story. But unfortunately, we are going to have to leave that for another day and enter a slightly more modern era of political assassinations. And everyone in the audience, I assume, knows about the G agents and the V agents that were developed during World War II. It was in the early 1970s that the Russians began to work on their own series of nerve agents that they called the A series or the Novichok agents. But it wasn't until the 1980s, in response to the United States developing binary nerve agents, that the Soviet Union started their Foliant program with the goal of developing the same. They wanted in on that action of binary nerve agents, and it's known that they were able to develop at least two binary A-series agents, which you can actually see in the bottom right are the binary forms of their two agents, Russian VX, also known as RVX or Substance 33, and A-232. On the bottom left, it's just the United States' own binary agents. But before there were the Skripals and before Alexei Navalny, the first well-documented poisoning with a Novichok agent was in this gentleman, Ivan Kivalidi, a Russian businessman. He was born in Abkhazia, which is in the modern state of Georgia, and he studied economics at Cambridge before coming back to Russia to become an extremely successful businessman. And among many other very successful ventures, he is well known for having organized the Russian Business Roundtable, which brought together all of the most elite Russian businessmen, bankers, and industrialists to form the group that would later become known as the oligarchs. He and his secretary were both exposed to a Novichok agent that was apparently applied to the office telephone receiver. It was August 1st, 1995, that Kivalidi was in his office when he suddenly felt ill. He fainted, supposedly gasping for breath. He's taken to the hospital where they struggle to diagnose him. They call it first one thing, then another, but they really can't figure out what's going on. And the plot thickens the next day when Kivalidi's secretary, Zara Ismailova, is taken to another hospital with the same symptoms. Now, she died the following day on August 3rd, and Kivalidi died the day after her. And reminiscent of the Salisbury incident, there were also two investigators who were inspecting Kivalidi's office who also became symptomatic, although they survived. But it was discovered by forensic analysis and confirmed by a former Russian chemical weapons developer that there was an organic phosphorus agent similar to VX. So presumably the Novichok agent, Russian VX, or its binary version that had been applied to his telephone. And there's this forensic report which describes that the substance was found on the telephone receiver, as well as the telephone itself and the number buttons on the telephone. And although this isn't actually the part of the forensic report that says where the poison was applied, it describes the nature of the chemical that they found, which was, I know this is Russian, but maybe you can pick out that it is an anticholinesterase chemical, organophosphorus in nature, which was a chemical weapons grade poisonous substance similar to VX. And that brings my final story to a close. I have a summary slide here. We have some references. I thank you very much.